mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Benares, bound to reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. Douglas Kruse is the author of 1385. I finished snooping around the house at dusk and took a seat on the edge of the stone front porch overlooking a wooded canyon. Lounging there with my feet dangling into space, I fancied I might have been invited to stay for a roasted venison dinner if only I had arrived a bit earlier, 700 years earlier. The house I visited, a remarkable, well-preserved cliff dwelling, was tucked away like a secret in a remote nook of the Superstition Mountains east of Phoenix. The Salado Indians called this place home around A.D. 1300. This ruin rates as the grand centerpiece, but by no means the only attraction, of a leisurely 4.2-mile one-way backpack trip into Rogers Canyon. The lush streamside scenery, sheer rock walls, abundant wildlife, moderate weather, and well-maintained trail would make the canyon a worthy destination, even if it sheltered not the slightest archaeological tidbit. Photographer Carrick James and I trekked into the canyon on a splendid spring weekend when everything conspired to see us walk in beauty. The weather remained warm but well shy of hot. The skies stayed clear except for the few fluffy clouds that broke up the blue. Rogers Creek in the canyon bottom obligingly collected itself into occasional small pools just right for a cooling dip, and getting to the Rogers Trailhead, the starting point for the hike, offered a pleasing back road adventure in its own right. The approach drive from Florence Junction took us through a classic Sonoran desert terrain with its lush growths of saguaro and cholla cacti, palo verde trees, and spring green lowland shrubs. Craggy rock towers like the 4,230-foot Hackberry Butte reminded us that we were heading into one of Arizona's most scenic and rugged mountain ranges. We found ourselves glad to be traveling in a four-wheel drive vehicle as we chugged in low gears up the final 3.9 miles of the road to the trailhead. Rogers Canyon lies in the 160,000-acre Superstition Wilderness within the Tonto National Forest. Like Grand Canyon trekking, hiking Rogers Canyon involves downhill coasting on the way in, then paying your dues with an uphill walk on the way out. Happily, the hike to the cliff dwellings at an elevation of 3,800 feet follows mostly easy angle trails, and the 1,040-foot elevation gain on the return trek seems reasonable payment for the sightseeing. James and I set off on the trailhead bearing overnight packs laden with lightweight camping gear and absurdly heavy photography equipment. As usual on our journeys together, I complained about the almost unbearable weight of my reporter's notebook and pen. As usual, he responded by rolling his eyes and handing me a heavy telephoto lens to add to my pack. Some hikers choose to make the jaunt to the cliff dwellings as a day trip. Go there, see that, dash home. Overnight and multi-day backpackers come with another agenda. It includes don't rush me stuff, sitting in the cool shade of streamside sycamores, memorizing the descending scale notes of the canyon wren's song, stopping to smell the manzanita, scrambling on rocks, taking side hikes to Sweetwater Springs, and savoring sunset from the terrace of a dwelling built 300 years before the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. The first part of the hike took us on a gradual down canyon amble on the Rivas Ranch Trail, which eventually veers away from Rogers Canyon and leads to a now abandoned ranch site pioneered by Elisha Rivas in the 1870s. The ranch and its remnant apple orchard also lie within the Tonto National Forest and their popular hiking destinations. Nearby blooms of red paintbrush, blue-purple sand verbena, and white yucca shouted spring from the sage-green brush. Juncos fleeted in trees up near the watercourse. About the time we were ready for a first slug of water from our canteens, we spotted two horseback riders dismounted near the trail and went over to share their patch of oak shade. "We've just got to get down there and see those cliff dwellings," one of the riders advised. They're so well preserved, it's like the people who live there must have left just recently. Spurred by this glowing review of sites to come, James and I hightailed it as much as anyone can with an overnight load on his back down the Rivas Ranch Trail to its intersection with the Rogers Canyon Trail. There, we took the left fork and continued following the Rogers Canyon Trail a couple of miles and hundreds of years into the past. Hikers who've roamed the Siri Desert, reachers of the superstitions, such as the prickly, rocky terrain of Peralta Canyon and soaring Weaver's Needle southwest of the area we were trekking, might find it hard to believe that they're in the same range when they descend into the heart of Rogers Canyon. The sheltering canyon walls and nurturing creek have fostered a narrow, linear forest of enormous sycamore, ash, walnut, and assorted varieties of oak trees, as well as canyon bottom shrubs. This classic riparian or streamside habitat provides a shady haven for birds and other wildlife and something like heaven for backpackers running low on sunscreen. James, experiencing a sort of riparian rapture, suggested that we stop for a dip in one of several inviting pools near the trail, but I couldn't wait to check out the prehistoric pad at 1385 Salado Drive, or whatever the address might have been, and I talked him into saving the soak for our return trek. Relying on maps and guidebooks, we began to watch for the cliff dwellings where the trail angled left from northwest to west as it skirted a band of steep cliffs. We found them easily just across the trickling creek from the trail and roughly 100 feet above the canyon bottom in a natural alcove in the rock. The Salado settlement, ensconced under a rock overhang that shelters it from the elements, consists of some partially eroded structures and one magnificently preserved room with its walls intact and much of its twig and mud roof in nearly mint condition. The place seems more of an outpost than a long-lost city like Mesa Verde in Colorado or Chacho Canyon in New Mexico, but what it lacks in size and grandeur, it possesses in intimacy and seclusion. We had the site to ourselves. Because the area sees relatively few visitors compared with more accessible spots, personal safety and protecting the fragile ruin from damage are extremely important. James and I, with plenty of experience in scrambling on rocks, ascended easily to the cliff dwellings, but anyone uncomfortable with such maneuvers can enjoy the magnificent sight of the ruin from below. Like other conscientious visitors, we refrained from climbing on the walls or removing anything from the site. It was a simple matter of visiting respectfully, as if the Salado were still at home. James and I took a preliminary tour of the dwellings in the afternoon. We planned to return around sunset after setting up camp down canyon and taking a side hike to Angel Basin about a quarter mile from the ruin. We were good little campers, too. Not only did we pick a sandy site where we wouldn't harm vegetation, we also took care to stash our food and toilet items in nylon bags and suspend them from tree limbs high above the ground to avoid attracting rodents or other animals. We enjoyed our afternoon reconnaissance of Angel Basin and points beyond. We spotted deer. We spotted hummingbirds. We checked out a side canyon. We took photographs. We took notes. And then we stopped by our camp before returning to the ruin for some end-of-the-day contemplation. There must have been one amazingly agile squirrel or some other ingenious, felonious critter living near our campsite. "Where's that big purple bag I hung up in the big oak?" I inquired of James. "I have no clue," he responded, "but I see the other bag over there on the ground." The second bag lay on the ground near the tree. It had been partially looted of its store of food. I picked up the remains, and then we spent a half hour scouring the area for the large purple bag, the one that contained most of James's food, all of our coffee, my toothbrush, toothpaste, and sunscreen. Gone. Something, my money is on a representative of the squirrel family, apparently zipped up the trunk of the big oak, scampered out to the very end of a limb, somehow managed to loosen the cords suspending the two bags and dropped them to the ground. We never found the large bag. Evidently, we interrupted the raid before the little buck-toothed bandit could get away with the smaller bag. Later in the evening, we would share the remaining rations for a most modest repast. My oral hygiene would suffer for the rest of the trip, but even a growling stomach and a yen for rodent revenge couldn't spoil the experience of spending sunset and twilight on the ancient's front porch. James busied himself with manners photographic while I took another look around the ruin and then settled down on the ledge out front to savor the end of the day, just as I imagined the Salado home folks might have done all those years ago. The sound of croaking frogs drifted up from pools in the tranquil creek. Fading light bled the last color out of rock walls across the canyon. A breeze whispered through the ruin. Archaeologists aren't sure why the Salado abandoned this place. It might have been drought. It might have been famine. It might have been war. But I was pretty sure of one thing. It wasn't because they didn't like the view from their front porch. And this concludes 1385. Kathleen Walker is the author of Confessions of an Arizona Loon. Do you bird? Our guide asks. No, I write for Arizona Highways, I respond, hoping this explains my thus far unremarkable presence on our tour of the bird life of Tohono O'odham Park in northwest Tucson. But, I added quickly, I do like birds. What's not to like? Birds of my acquaintance appear to do little harm, spending most of their time sitting in trees, looking for food, building nests. Birds give us something nice to look at and listen to when we are doing nothing much else. I've long played with the idea of bird watching as a hobby, imagining the leisurely walks through the great out-of-doors. The free tour offered by Tohono O'odham seemed like a good place to start. The trails and gardens of the park give visitors a close look at the plants of the Sonoran Desert. With the plants come the birds of the desert, so joining the migratory morning hour pattern of other Tucsonans, I made my way to the park for one of my first birding expeditions. The experience will prove to be far more complicated and faster paced than I had imagined. For one thing, you have to see the bird. The park booklet lists 45 of the most common species to be found in its environs, including hawks, doves, owls, hummingbirds, thrashers, and one type of vulture. Yet during the tour's first half hour, I don't see a feather, much less the whole package, unless someone else points the way. These guys are fast, and I don't mean the birds. The first call goes out, mockingbirds in the date palms. My fellow tour takers snap to attention. I stare upward, hopefully. Another bird spotted. The tour takers raise their heads and binoculars in a synchronized motion that would stun a rocket. I have no binoculars. I squint ever upward. Do you see his wing patches? Our guide asks about a bird they found in another tree. Wing patches? Where's the bird? Oh, the tremulous sighs rise as binocular-enhanced heads move in a mashed arching swivel. A cardinal. Where? Woo! Heads swivel again, mine following three wing beats behind. This time I catch a glimpse of a fast-moving patch of red. I'm surprised we didn't see any Gila woodpeckers today, comments a fellow tour participant as we walk. I grunt. I wouldn't know a Gila woodpecker if one got caught in my hair. But even without the binoculars, and minus the eyes of a hawk, I find myself getting into the spirit of the occasion. I walk softly and keep my voice low. No, better than low. I'm all but mute. I'm not as worried about scaring the birds as I am about shocking my fellow birders. Every step of the tour has brought me closer and closer to the realization that I know almost nothing about birds. Oh, I can pick out a dove or a quail, but consider the cactus wren, the Arizona state bird, and one I should know. Used to the likes of us, the Tohono O'odham cactus wrens gab away as we walk past. One joins us on the trail, dancing around our feet. Sweet. Wait a second. This long-tailed, striped-bodied bird is a cactus wren? I always thought they were starlings. I have spent years shooting dirty looks at the state bird, thinking of them as unwanted guests in the territory of my feathered Arizona friends. Well, I am learning, and I'm beginning to spot birds almost as quickly as the others do. One specimen sits on a branch directly over my head. Get a good look at his eye, is the advice. I don't have the eye, but I do have excellent view of his fluffy underpants. Having almost been hit on the head earlier by a falling date, I move along. We see gambel's quail in the undergrowth, hummingbirds in the gardens. We spot a number of heretofore elusive Gila woodpeckers, the males sporting their distinctive red beanie spots on the top of their heads. House finches cavort, black as night male phainopellas preen for their gray lady loves. Morning doves watch us watching them. You should know, birding can become a real obsession with people, says the guide with a smile. Yes, but I still seem to be spending a fair amount of my time looking at the branches of bird-empty trees or sighting species we have already seen. I would like to make my own first sighting to spot something new. Then I see them, a bunch of chubby little grayish birds sitting on a bush. Haven't seen their like before, have we? I point them out to the guide. Sparrows, she tells me. I think she says they are white crowned sparrows, perhaps a step up from the everyday variety, but certainly no western kingbird, no ash-throated flycatcher, certainly no vulture. Ah, well, on life's little journeys, even the loons among us have to start somewhere. And this concludes Confessions of an Arizona Loon. Betty Marvin is the author of Explore Aravaipa Canyon. Look for the sign that says Abe White Bridge, I read from the directions I jotted down. Watch for the white trailer. The next driveway is Carol's. My husband and I come to the bridge, then the, whoops, trailer. We skitter past a little track that evaporates over the side of the hill, crunching gravel as we slide to a stop, then back up. That must be it. There is a creek down there, and Carol says we have to cross it twice. We're on our way to Aravaipa Farms to meet photographer Peter Enzenberger at this out-of-the-way bed and breakfast southeast of Wickelman. It lies about 6 miles from Aravaipa Canyon West Trailhead, the entrance to a lush riparian greenbelt that skirts Aravaipa Creek. The last 3.5 miles on Aravaipa Road have been dirt, but easy driving. Carol Steele, we soon learn, makes finding her guest farm well worth our trip. Owner of this wilderness retreat, Steele is a well-known businesswoman and gourmet chef from Scottsdale who chucked city life about 6 years ago to create this Eden on the creek bank. Larry backs up the blazer and we idle for a moment, ogling the tidy rows of neatly trimmed peach, pear, and apricot trees that lie below us, their undulating white and pale pink blooms creating a surreal, impressionistic cloud. Our weekend plans include a hike in the canyon, but in addition, a compromise. My husband adores backpacks and beef jerky snacks while touting a hunting rifle 10 miles into rugged mountains looking for wild pigs. I love to hike the wilds, but prefer hot water that pours from a faucet to a campfire blackened kettle. Staying here at the farm instead of in a tent means we'll both be happy. If my husband were telling this, he'd wax eloquent about the more than 200 species of birds. Maybe you'll see a buff-colored nightjar or a peregrine falcon that live in this secretive canyon along with javelinas, mule deer, and bighorn sheep. Or he might describe how Aravaipa is one of the few creeks in Arizona that flows year-round and thus supports giant cottonwood, ash, and sycamore trees along its banks. He's also likely to mumble something about several species of rattlesnakes to watch out for, but you have to listen closely. Two figures gesture from the gate ahead as we drive through the acres of blossoms. One waves her hand, the other a long, fluffy tail. Einstein, Steele's black and white shepherd, gives me a two paws on the chest welcome the moment I open the vehicle door. He's so friendly because he thinks you came just to see him, Steele says, laughing. Pull your car up there next to the first casita. The little stucco house snuggles against a stone wall at the base of Steele's very own mountain, an old-fashioned front porch gussied up with tongue-in-cheek creativity with a southwestern flavor, sports a profusion of color, kitsch, rustic and rustling oddities that in a less artistic setting might be considered trash. Here, they're an integral part of a carefully choreographed still life, a Matisse, come alive, primitive chic. We unload our suitcases, following like Dorothy and Oz, an imaginative path, not a yellow brick road, but a concrete sidewalk embedded with interesting pieces of broken dishes, native rock, Satillo tile, and odds and ends of Mexican ceramics. Paintings and flower pots grace the patio, and the wide use of fieldstone and Satillo tile inside blurs distinctions between indoors and outdoors. In our room, the king-sized bed with its plump green plaid duvet cover and throw pillows almost purrs an invitation to put up my feet and rejuvenate the golden hammock at the end of the rainbow. But it's the quiet I notice most. I can hear a bumblebee doing his work somewhere outside and around the corner. Funky giant chairs made from peach tree trimmings dot the yard and patios. We waste nothing here at the farm, the workmen tell us the next morning as we watch them cutting lengths of tree branches for art and furniture projects that Steele designs and sells from a gift shop. Steele calls Aravaipa Farms a reversed B&B. She fills a cupboard and baskets in the rooms with self-serve breakfast of cheeses, fresh fruit, granola, breads, juices, and coffee, then joins her guests for a gourmet communal dinner in her home on the property. After a meal of Moroccan chicken, fresh green beans, and homemade jalapeno focaccia bread, followed by appleberry crumble dessert, Enzenberger groans, "I think this will be the first hiking trip I've photographed when I've gained weight. I'll have lunches ready to take with you on the hike tomorrow morning," Steele reminds us. Aravaipa Canyon offers a kind of buffet of hiking. "I rate myself as just a few heel blisters past novice, so I intend to simply follow the main trail. For the more experienced and ardent hiker, however, there's plenty of rock climbing as well as 9 side canyons to explore. But we're here for a semi-leisurely day hike and great pictures, so we sign our names and deposit our $5 each at the trailhead the next morning." The 1.1-mile downhill lead-in trail on a pea gravel path drops steeply in spots, and anyone in shoes without a good grip could easily carry home a bruised posterior or worse. Once we reach steam bed level, however, the path flattens and generally stays that way. Near the creek, undergrowth thins, but the rock slides close in and the ground trail disappears frequently. We wade in the clear, gentle stream a half dozen times before coming to a fence and a small faded sign that confirms we're in a designated wilderness. These are the only directions we see. The creek or its nearby burble serves as our sole guide. Bird songs accompany the profusion of tiny cottonwood tufts over our heads that lift and fall with every whiff of breeze, dancing diamonds that catch the sun, blinking with each twist and tumble. Enzenberger spots the white tips on the wings of a Phainopepla diving for insects. Larry recognizes an adolescent bald eagle. We'd heard reports of black bear and mountain lion sightings, but they're obviously avoiding us. We see plenty of javelina tracks and deer scat near the water. Despite its enticing appearance, this wild passageway demands respect. Though open to thousands of sightseers, Aravaipa Canyon remains a land of extremes and contrast. Sultry summers with 110-plus degree highs evolve into freezing temperatures during November through March. Even August nights can fall below 60 degrees. Terrain and vegetation also display a split personality. Luxuriant, water-loving cottonwoods quiver against a backdrop of desert plants. Saguaro and staghorn cacti protrude from red and white striated 1,000-foot cliffs with no visible signs of dirt in which to anchor. Huge boulders that seem to come from nowhere block the water's flow on a smooth marble-sized gravel creek bed, a creek that can turn from tranquil to torrent in minutes. Flash floods in rainy season are an annual event. Be that as it may, human beings have been drawn to this verdant canyon since prehistoric times. According to the Bureau of Land Management, Aravaipa Canyon may have been inhabited by the Cochise culture as long ago as 10,000 years, disappearing about 2,000 years ago. 1,000 years after that, the Mogollon, Salado, and Hohokam tribes moved in to take advantage of the consistent water supply for farming and for the abundant hunting and fishing. For centuries, the 11-mile canyon represented a shortcut through rugged mountains that a strong scout could cover in just a few hours. More recently, 19th-century Aravaipa Apaches used the canyon for their homes and corrals and as a part of their raiding route into Sonora, Mexico. After the government relegated the tribe to the San Carlos Indian Reservation, gorges that connect to Aravaipa Canyon provided escapees like Geronimo and the Apache Kid ample places to hide from the U.S. cavalry among hundreds of concealed caves and labyrinth rock formations. By noon, I'm sure we've ambled at least 3 miles. Enzenberger, one of those avid-type hunters, smiles when I mention this, and my shins are crying uncle from this unaccustomed rubbing against my boot tops. But the day seems idyllic, a gift of exercise for the spirit and body, aided, of course, by Steele's delectable lunch that includes turkey, avocado, and sprout sandwiches slathered with her secret sauce. Later that afternoon, we greet three retirement-age Australian couples. We cross paths with less than a dozen people, returning to the trailhead where I'd first seen them that morning. They're laughing and teasing one man, razzing him about being afraid of a little water. He passes on a warning. Just a bit upstream, you go through water up to your knees. It gets very rapid, and the walls are too close for my liking. Although his group pooh-poohs his fright, we find the spot around the neck bend and decide he was wise to be cautious. A small rapids keeps us on our toes, and water goes above my knees. The ground path has disappeared again, but the walls are at least 30 to 40 feet apart. When the creek flows normally, this is about as high as it gets, though there are spots with deep holes. Since it's past midday, we choose to turn around at this point. And besides, Enzenberger wants to backtrack to photograph in perfect afternoon light a lone cottonwood tree that grows in a narrow side canyon amid boulders the size of my bedroom. Larry takes advantage of the rest stop to pull out a map and calculate our progress. He points to a short, thin line. I think we went about this far, just beyond Hell's Half Acre, he says. If that's right, that means we've hiked about 1.5 miles into the wilderness. Now I'm convinced it's time to get into better shape. Along the way in, we literally stopped to smell flowers, examine animal signs, and discuss the birds and our good fortune for being in this place on this day. My return trek, on the other hand, becomes more of a heads down, one foot in front of the other march. I just tell myself that tonight I will stand in a hot shower and sleep in a king-size bed under a plump green plaid duvet. Ah, sweet compromise. And this concludes Explore Aravaipa Canyon. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams rise of those cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.